Friends, I think this is the fourth time that I'm here in the Indian Embassy, and I feel happy to be here addressing each time new public. Well, since 2001 I have been coming to Berlin, and right in my first visit I fell in love with this city and of course its people. Well, I had a great urge to see Berlin since my childhood days, because it was Sri Aurobindo who had referred a lot to the German history in one of his major books, The Ideal of Human Unity. So since I was a student at the ashram, I had a kind of a desire to see for myself the history that Sri Aurobindo spoke of, especially of the German history. So I happened to come here for some lectures, and then I saw history for myself. And then of course I had a kind of a deeper vision of the whole thing. I did not take history as it happened on the surface, because normally we do get in history books what happened during the Second War and the First War and the building up of German Empire, etc. But fortunately Sri Aurobindo had given us a deeper insight into what Germany as a national soul represents in this family of nations. Well, since then I've been coming whenever I had the opportunity, and back home at Oroville we have lots of Germans there, and living in Pondicherry I do go to Oroville very often and connect myself with the Germans. Well, this time again I had the opportunity to come here to attend an Oroville International meeting coming this week sometime. And then I thought of really sharing with you some of the ideas that Sri Aurobindo has given us, especially with regard to the present human crisis. You see, it's quite a cliche by now, because most of the persons have spoken about a crisis that is happening in humanity at present. We call it a global crisis, and then some people even tell us about the possibility of the human extinction. There are quite many incidents that tell us about this possibility of humanity facing a dire consequence. Right in the beginning of this century we have had this 9/11, and till the latest that we have had in India, 26/11, we have seen a rising growth of terror all over the world. And to cap it all, we have at present what we call the economic meltdown, and the media especially has given us a very good picture of what's happening across USA and Europe, and of course we see that effect in India too. But for me all these are only symptomatic of another crisis, of a deeper crisis. And humanity and human scholars and researchers and historians and sociologists do not go that deep. They see and want to tackle with the symptoms of human ailment. And therefore, I wanted to see what Sri Aurobindo himself has to say in this regard. Because you see, Sri Aurobindo wrote long back, around 1914, almost 100 years back, about the political situation that's going to come up in the world at large. And you may think, what could he have written 100 years back, because in between we have had the two great wars. But Sri Aurobindo foresaw these wars, foresaw what would be the outcome of these wars, and then he foresaw the crisis that humanity will undergo. And then what's most beautiful is that he foresaw a splendid spiritual age that will dawn at the end of all this crisis. So though during the World War, the First and the Second, he lived through, and while there was this First War, he wrote this book called The Idol of Human Unity. And then later when he revised that book, it was after the Second War. And then what's magnificent is that he was never a pessimist. He never took these world dangers, which at that time were really so very global, threatening the entire human culture. But still, here was a yogi, a visionary, who could see beyond the present. So that's what is supremely beautiful about his vision, that in spite of the holocaust of human nature and culture and nations during the two wars, he foresaw the spiritual age. And of this, you know, many people in the world across have spoken about the crisis. And right from 1908, when Gandhiji in India called the attention to the diseased character of modern civilization, there was Vivekananda and Tagore who were aware of the flaws in Western patterns of social and political organization. And then we have also in the West Sorokin, Spengler, who also spoke about the possibilities of the Western civilization coming to an end. Well, there are views and views, but most of them having a kind of a view which is the dead end of human civilization. But it's only in Sri Aurobindo that I found a positive message. And what he would tell us in a remarkable passage, I quote here, "At present, mankind is undergoing an evolutionary crisis in which is concealed a choice of its destiny." Imagine he wrote this around 1914 to 18. So even then he saw these external symptoms as a symptom of a true crisis of consciousness. What he calls evolutionary crisis, in which is concealed a choice of its destiny. But this is what most of the historians and the sociologists do not find, that there is a deeper crisis in human nature and human consciousness. And unless and until we tackle this human consciousness, we cannot find any permanent solution. So he says further, "For a stage has been reached in which the human mind has achieved in certain directions an enormous development while in others it stands arrested and bewildered and can no longer find its way. A structure of the external life has been raised up by man's ever-active mind and life will, a structure of an unmanageable hugeness and complexity. If that was the hugeness and complexity in the early 1900s, you can imagine what's the present situation. A massive hugeness, and he would tell us that this hugeness and complexity, for the service of his mental, vital, physical claims and urges, a complex political, social, administrative, economic, cultural machinery, an organized collective means for his intellectual, sensational, aesthetic and material satisfaction. Man has created a system of civilization which has become too big for his limited mental capacity and understanding, and his still more limited spiritual and moral capacity to utilize and manage. A too dangerous servant of his blundering ego and its appetites. A greater whole being, whole knowledge, whole power is needed to weld all into a greater unity of whole life. So what we marvel at is this forevision, the foresight. And what he says here, as you have seen, that this is too huge for mankind to deal. In fact, later on in the same book, he would tell us that the outer developments may become so big that humanity may not be able to handle with it. And there is a possibility that it could drive itself towards its own suicide, because the outer overweighs the inner development. That's why he had an urgent message to say that a greater whole being, whole knowledge, whole power is needed to weld all into a greater unity of whole life. Well, having said that, he in that book, Idol of Human Unity, analyzes, and that's what is great about Sri Aurobindo's writing, it is analytical. Is not just a prophetic claims and proclamation saying that this will happen. In fact, he did mention as I just now was talking to Mr. Rakesh Ranjan, right in 1918 he had foreseen the formation of European Union. Not only foreseen, he even gave us the steps. What would be the steps that Europe would go through and come at last to a European Union. Imagine in those years, hardly this concept was ever even discussed in the world scenario. But here was a man who had written in the books. And today, if you go back to those chapters in the Idol of Human Unity, and you will see exactly the same steps that humanity has struggled but come through, and then here we have the reality of a European Union. But what I want to tell you is not proclamations. Not declarations. It's always a beautiful rational analysis. So it's very convincing to read his books. They are really visions translated into a rational language. And having seen the deeper dilemma of mankind, now he would tell us what has mankind done to really get away from this crisis. Mankind has tried many a step, but then ultimately he says that none of the steps have really proven right. So it's only at the end of this analysis, which is very rational and pragmatic, that he would conclude with saying that there is no other way but the spiritual. We'll come to that when we come to that. That we will see, the first analysis is that of a rationalized society. Because the Western mind especially, do not mistake me if I say the Western mind is not derogative, but it is the Western mind which has really spearheaded a movement of rationalism, which even now in India and in the East is coming up, but still it doesn't have the priority. So it's in that context I refer to the Western mind initiating the movement of a rationalized society. Now, it is true that with the coming of the scientific age, rationalism took an upper hand. And then we thought that a rationalized society would be an ideal society, because Western world especially, and even in the East, we were suffering the dark ages. We were under the superstitious age of religion. We were suffocated with all the superstitions, religious control and all that. And science gave us a promise telling us, we will bring a rationalist society which will really give mankind liberation. But here, Sri Aurobindo, knowing very well the importance of reason in life, because remember, he had spent almost 14 years of his first period of his life in England, and he had read the best of the world's history books in every language possible. And those languages were Greek, Latin, French, German, Hebrew. So you can see the best of the Western literature, history, literature, philosophy, sociology, he had read and mastered. So here was a man who could now have the full control and have the full vision of what rationalistic society means. So he had the right to really comment, because having gone through for 14 years the best of the Western civilization, he says ultimately, a purely rational society could not come into being if it could be born, either could not live or would sterilize and petrify human existence. You see, we respect his views, not because he's an Indian yogi, but then here was a man who had gone through this entire parameters of a rationalist society, and then he comes to a conclusion that if it is born at all, of course he would say, it cannot come into fullness. We have a rationalistic society, but then he says that it would not live or would sterilize and petrify human existence. So this kind of a petrification is what is really taking up our present human society. And then he would say that the main reason why he rejects a rationalistic society is that reason itself is not the highest achievement of human consciousness. Although he would tell us that at present humanity has the mind, the mental consciousness, reason as the highest faculty. But that's a faculty that does not have this originality of creativity. Reason is only an analyst. It gathers information and analyzes and divides and then finds out a conclusion. So by itself, reason is not something that really gives you original ideas. And then the most important thing is, he would say, there are higher levels than reason in human consciousness which can be attained. And in fact, he would say, future of humanity is moving toward these higher faculties than the mind. So having realized this as a yogi, and I say this again and again, as a yogi, because through his meditation and practices of yoga, what is subsequently called as the integral yoga, he realized that there are states of minds beyond this human intellect, which he called the higher mind, the illumined mind, the intuitive mind, the overmind, and the supermind. So having seen these ranges of consciousness, of levels of mind, he says humanity is at one of the lowest levels. We at present think our mind is great, rationalism is the greatest thing that humanity has achieved. But one who has seen this, he says, no. This is just the beginning of human faculties that are opening. To be called man is to be called a mental being. But man is beginning to be the real man once he reaches the mental consciousness. But he can exceed and surpass his mental consciousness. And therefore he would say that there is a thing, a consciousness beyond mine, which needs to be realized. And not only needs to be realized, he foresees that mankind will go through all this external crisis, but someday, one day, in one decade, is bound to reach that higher consciousness which we call the spiritual consciousness. So once, at one go, he believes in reason, but then he believes more in what is beyond reason. So there's a famous phrase in Sri Aurobindo which is very oft quoted. It's called reason is the bar, reason is the helper, reason is the bar. So up until now, reason has been a helper to mankind in its progress. But now, reason is the bar. So it is not allowing us to go beyond, and therefore he would tell us, it is through yoga, the practice of integral yoga. And it is integral yoga is not as is usually understood asanas of Hatha yoga. It's a completely new practice wherein we see we can reach these levels beyond mind. So that's the reason why he does not denounce reason, obviously not, but he says we must exceed this man's mental consciousness. And then he also analyzes how reason has brought forth these three fundamental political formations called what we have normally democracy, communism and socialism. You see, here we are dealing with these outer patterns that mankind has brought forth as solutions. Now he would take up each ism, democracy, communism, socialism, and then analyze and see how good are they and why have they really failed humanity? What are its drawbacks? You see, he is a rationalist himself because he follows this method of really taking up an issue, looking at it from all sides, and then it's not out of prejudice he will reject rationalism. But then once he sees it is incomplete, then he will take up another issue. So first let us take up democracy itself. He says, Sri Aurobindo examines first the rational and scientific formula of the vitalistic and materialistic human being and his life, a search for a perfected economic society and the democratic cultus of the average man. Now you see here, it's all too good to speak about democracy. The whole world is talking about it. It's become quite a major political ideal that we should have democracy in every country. But is democracy the solution for the future of humanity? Regarding India, especially, he says in black and white that it doesn't really suit the Indian culture. Democracy, although it really is a modern fashionable term in political circles, he tells us the Indian ethos does not fit into democracy. But he would also say that it is again India which has to go through this democratic system and find out and tell humanity its drawback and then find a new solution. Well, that's a different part. But what I want to tell you is that democracy is not necessarily the best form of political organization. But democracy, we say this freedom, of course. Freedom is a very valued value. All of us need freedom. In fact, he would defend that each human being must have the ultimate possible freedom. Because freedom is the only way that one can grow. Grow externally and spiritually. So freedom is a fundamental value for Sri Aurobindo. is a fundamental spiritual value. It is not just a social value that is given in each one of us constitution, freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of expression. It is freedom that gives you growth. So that he values, but not as a democratic system. He would tell us that democracy cannot realize the ideals of unity, mutuality, and harmony for the common life. There is an overstandardization in the process of effectuation of these ideals because of the suppression of individual diversities. You see, each country, we have a lot of diversity. But in this diversity, we are all moving out into the diversity, but this question of unity, what we call the unity, mutuality and harmony, they are not maintained. You see, it's as if you have given up the search for harmony and unity, and then you say, each one of you be diverse as much as possible. But Sri Aurobindo is looking for human unity, which he says the democratic system may not be able to deliver. There is a danger of the exclusion of other competing thought structures in this system. Furthermore, there are chances of the replacement of the individual ego by the communal ego. This is one of the major criticisms against democracy, that we have individual freedom, but we develop a communal ego. You see, in India especially, I do not have experience of the Western community here, but we have all come down into communal egos, which are really hampering the unity of India, unitarian movement of the country. Because long back when India got its freedom in 1947, Sri Aurobindo had written a grand message, an open message to the country, wherein he gives his five dreams, the magnificent dreams which really almost tell us about the evolutionary process of humanity itself. The first dream, he says, would be the freedom of the country, freedom of India. A dream which got fulfilled in his own lifetime. Then he says, my second dream is the rise of Asia. Imagine, he wrote this in 1947, and since then Asian countries have risen up, grand way, almost competing the West in every possible manner. Then the third dream, he says, is overflowing of spiritual knowledge from India. And precisely that's what has happened in the 60s, 70s and 80s. There has been an overflow of Indian spirituality. Because that's where he would tell, in fact, when he was fighting for the freedom of the country, he was indeed a revolutionary. But he was not a political revolutionary in the common sense of the word. He said India must gain freedom, not just for herself, but for the sake of humanity. You see, every country wants to be free, but he said Indian freedom has a different connotation, because it's only a free country which can give to the world something of its own. A country which is under slavery cannot give, because even if it is given, it's not respected. And India, he says, has the knowledge that would save the world in the future. And that spiritual knowledge, which was hidden in the ethos of the Vedas and the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita, he said, one day humanity will survive by that knowledge. So it is urgent that India should get freedom, not for herself, but for the sake of humanity. And that's the knowledge, he said, that will overflow India and go to the entire world. That was his third dream. And then of course the fourth dream, which is really what is taking shape today, and we will come to that in a little while, but let me mention that right now, is the human unity. Unity of mankind. And that too in 1947, the wars were just over, and then he speaks that humanity will go towards a world unity. And then the fifth dream is perhaps strange to many of you here, but those of you who have read Sri Aurobindo, it won't surprise you. He says, in order to bring down this human unity, we need a greater force, a greater consciousness than just the mental consciousness that has been here all these centuries. And that new force, that greater consciousness, he calls the supramental consciousness. And in his sadhana, in his tapasya, in his yoga, for 40 years, from 1910 to 1950, he struggled to bring that force down. In fact, he quit the revolutionary movement in Bengal, where he was already a national hero. In fact, the entire British kingdom was after him because Sri Aurobindo proved to be the most dangerous man for the British Empire. Because he had inspired the youth so much that the Britishers were really wanting to capture him. But he did not run away from the field. He prepared the field, gave it to other younger generation, and then he withdrew to Pondicherry. Not as a withdrawal as an ascetic, but because he wanted this new force, this new consciousness called the supramental, which alone can bring down this human unity in the future. So you see, as he was a visionary, he could see centuries ahead. He knew that if I don't bring down the supramental now, humanity may not be able to survive the way it is growing. So we should understand that his withdrawal to Pondicherry was not a running away from political scenario, but it was for the sake of humanity. He had worked for his country, short 6 to 7 years, and he had given to country the direction of the freedom movement, because it was he who had laid down the principles of India's freedom movement, which subsequently were taken up by Gandhiji and Subhash Chandra Bose. But the foundations of the movement, it was Sri Aurobindo who gave to India. Unfortunately, not many recognize that in the country because of the political interests, but this is what history tells us. However, he goes to Pondicherry and attempts for that new supramental consciousness. And it is in 1950 when the supramental descends into his body that he sacrifices his own physical body. So you see, these are the five dreams which he speaks of in 1947. And that's why we would say that he envisioned this new system, a new direction to mankind's social thought, political thought. So as we are analyzing, democracy itself was not suitable, at least to India, and we'll see future what happens. Then coming to what we call the communism. Well, while there was the great communist movement in Soviet Union, Sri Aurobindo wrote about that, supported that, and we find his writings in The Idol of Human Unity again. But then again, characteristically, he writes there, within about 20 to 25 years, this movement will come to an end. And that's what we saw happening in the last century. So you see, he saw the good point of all this movement, because he is one who never rejected any human effort for progress. But his integral vision always demanded a unitarian vision, a spiritual vision. So he said all this communist movement is also important to bring a new dimension to humanity. And this new dimension had its effect. But then he would say, it is based on a forced compression and imposed unanimity of mind and life and a mechanical organization of the communal existence. So this is where it led to the suppression of the individual freedom. And Sri Aurobindo foresaw that communism would fall because it suppresses the human individual freedom. So you see, all this today we come to know. Many writers have written about that today, or last decade, or last 15 years. But here was a man who wrote about it a century back. Because this is the value he gave to the individual freedom, that whichever system suppresses the individual freedom will not last long. So that was the end of communism. And then we have socialism. And this is where he says, the development of an enlightened reason and will of the normal man consenting to a new socialized life in which he will subordinate his ego for the sake of the right arrangement of the life of the community. You see, where the state becomes the owner of the individual self. So there was this socialistic movement. And then they said, the socialistic movement said, that we can increase this movement by growth of education and then by a new social machinery. But then Sri Aurobindo criticizes that although a better system of education can provide more information, it cannot change the nature of man. This is one of the important ideas. Education is important to bring a kind of an external social change in mankind. But Sri Aurobindo is looking for the inner change, the spiritual change. So he says, can any education bring about this kind of a change, especially a socialistic education? He says, it doesn't have much of a chance. Then the second thing about a new social order, a new social machinery, he would say, that also will not work in the long run. So ultimately, again he comes to the solution that it is only to discover the hidden depths of the soul and replace the disorder, that will be the solution. Now you see, I have given you just in a kind of an outline all these systems. There's much that can be said. But just to run through, these three systems he finds not adequate enough to change mankind. But there is one little passage which I like to read out, which is really absolutely reflecting the present scenario in the world. What has this rationalistic, materialistic, communist ideal brought about into humanity? For this ideal, this conscious stress on the material and economic life was in fact a civilized reversion to the first state of man, his early barbaric state, and his preoccupation with life and matter. A spiritual retrogression with the resources of the mind of a developed humanity and a fully evolved science at its disposal. I think there couldn't have been a better description of the present society, wherein we are all engaged in the preoccupation with life and matter. And he says it is a kind of a reversion to the early barbaric state. So what all we see, the violence, in whatever name we call it, people call it Taliban, people call it Naxals, people call it whatever. But violence is violence. But he says this is this barbaric state, because this has come about because we are so very preoccupied only with life and matter. This hardly a kind of a recognition even or acknowledgement even of a spiritual side of human being. So he says, because of that great sacrifice, humanity is going to go under danger. And the danger, he says, the first danger is a resurgence of the old vital and material primitive barbarian in a civilized form. The means science has put at our disposal eliminate the peril of the subversion and destruction of an effete civilization by stronger primitive peoples. But it is the resurgence of the barbarian in ourselves, in civilized man, that is the peril. So this is in fact the analysis of the violence that is around the world. There is within us somewhere this vital, barbaric violence that has come about. It's no use to say these people are violent, these people are terrorists, or these people are that. Because remember, friends, that what all happens in this world at large, there is the symptoms in each individual. Microcosm and macrocosm, they reflect each other. So what is happening in a certain group of people is only a reflection of what's happening within each one of us. And that's why Sri Aurobindo tells us that this is a resurgence of the barbarian in ourselves. And there is another danger, For a cessation of the evolutionary urge, a crystallization into a stable, comfortable, mechanized social living without ideal or outlook is another possible outcome. This is a magnificent analysis. That there could be, okay, even if we take away this violence, the Western countries, the European nation is very well established, stabilized. But then the danger is a crystallization into a stable, comfortable, mechanized social living. You see, in India, there is a story about, we have, you know, this Dashavatar, the 10 avatars. There is a story of Vaman avatar, that means a dwarf avatar, who once comes to a king, and then, you know, in those days when a Brahmin went to a king, it was customary for the king to say, "Oh Brahmin, whatever you want, I will give you." And this Vaman avatar, he said, "I want land enough to put 3 feet, 3 steps. He said, "Only that much land?" He said, "Yes." The king said, "Yes, you can take that much land, start walking." And after all, this Vaman avatar was the Lord himself come down as a human being. So first step in Indian mythology, he says, he put into Patal. Patal is the hell, the downward, the underworlds. And then the second step he put into heavens. So you see, these 2 steps have really covered both hell, the Patal, and the heaven. And then Lord Vamana says, "Where will I put my 3rd step? And the king says, "There's no other place, put it on my head." And that is a symbolic story, because this king had a perfect kingdom. No problems, nothing, no shortage of materials, perfect peace. But this is what it was, a crystallization into a stable, comfortable, mechanized social living without ideal. So Sri Aurobindo would tell us that any system of society which gets crystallized into this kind of a mental consciousness also cannot last. It will be destroyed, because it is nature herself which wants to go beyond. And therefore he says, every society has to look up for the next step in evolution, the spiritual evolution. So this is his, what we call, his analysis of the failure of the present systems. But then he also analyzes some other possibilities. Like we said, there could be a possibility of going back to a religious society. You see, if all the systems fail us, there could be a return to the religious idea and a society governed or sanctioned by religion. In fact, lots of religions are trying to do that, trying to reimpose themselves, saying that we will give you a new solution. But this religious idea, which, you know, I've seen in the recent times, that every religion is kind of, you know, revising its own principles in order to accommodate the present problems. Because it wants to exist, it wants to spread itself. But then he would say, even this religious idea trying to control will not be able to solve the human problems. Because basically, what religion does is it only shows the human being the path towards God. But it had to compromise with the lower parts of life and could not insist on the inner change. It could insist only on a cradle adherence. You see, religious ideology cannot change the human nature. It would say, "You stick to my creed, I'll give you a seat in heaven. I'll give you a priority to go to the heaven, you'll have the best of places." So Sri Aurobindo says, religion does not have the capacity or the force to change human nature. It at the most gives you a kind of an external polish, a kind of a satisfaction that you are spiritual, but really doesn't change much. And then he really also looks up into another possibility, that is a society guided by men of spiritual attainment. Now, this is something that is already happening in the present world. There are large groups, or many groups in the country or the world over, where spiritual masters have come about, in small groups, big groups, wherever, in India, in the West, and the US, wherein we say, we will guide the society, we will salvage humanity. But Sri Aurobindo again would say, this would not again last long, because the mind of the human beings will not be satisfied until it reaches the higher truth. So even the small groups will break up and break away. So he analyzed all this, and then ultimately there is one more ideal which is really gaining ground, that of the humanism. But that also, he would say, will it work or not? Now, humanistic philosophy, where man himself is the kind of the center of humanity, was in vogue, or is in vogue, where the human being becomes the most important focus. But there again he would say that if man is the measure of all things, we have to exceed and transmute this external empirical man. Please see, what he says is that humanism refers only to the empirical man. It doesn't refer to the spiritual man. So Sri Aurobindo doesn't want to encourage this empirical image of man, just the outer being, his mind, his society, his vital desires, his physical necessities. He says, this is not the ideal man. We have the deeper, greater human being called the spiritual being, or the soul, or what we say in India, the Atman. He says, that is the man I'm looking forward to, and not the empirical man. So again, he rejects humanism. And we have the possibility of ethical idealism. Well, even that he doesn't give much importance, because after all, he says, all ethical idealism is a mental product and it will not last. I'm touching upon different points only to tell you that he has really analyzed the entire present scenario, and then he would tell us what could be the solution to all this. With all this happening, the failures that humanity is facing, Sri Aurobindo sees a positive light somewhere. You see, after this huge analysis which runs almost through the entire book, the last one third of the book, he will now come to saying, there are some symptoms, there are some signs which he says, I see, which will definitely take humanity to the next age, the spiritual age. And one of them is the phenomenon of internationalism. Now that is what attracts Sri Aurobindo. The saying that this internationalism can really take humanity forward, and in fact this sense of internationalism grew out of the First War, when we had this League of Nations. So he would tell us that this is something incredible, that mankind had to sacrifice so much, go through so much of destruction through the First War. But then the fruit of this First War was a new concept of internationalism. And today, if we are speaking about Auroville, it is that sense, that feeling, that growth of human consciousness which is not taking a firm, concrete shape in Auroville. So you see, it is not a city that is coming up. It is the human consciousness itself which is being crystallized, which is being manifested in a place called Auroville. Because this is where Sri Aurobindo puts in his greatest hope, that this international spirit, which started with League of Nations, but which is bound to fail, because even in the ideal of human unity, he speaks about League of Nations, and immediately before it is destroyed, he says it will be destroyed. Because the basis was not right, but the concept was right. So then when the United Nations started, Sravanendra had great hopes. He says, this is the way that humanity must move. And to this, United Nations organizations, he gave towards the end when he revised his book, a beautiful paragraph. I'll read out that. And then you see how much of importance he puts into it. He said, this is the capital event, the crucial and decisive outcome of the worldwide tendencies which nature has set in motion for her destined purpose. In spite of the constant shortcomings of human effort and its stumbling mentality, in spite of adverse possibilities that may balk or delay for a time the success of this great adventure, it is in this event that lies the determination of what must be. You see, he has already foreseen, he says, in spite of the possibilities of constant stumbling mentality, in spite of adverse possibilities that may balk or delay for a time the success, there will be lots of problems. And we have seen United Nations has gone through many a problem. But then he says, that is the only hope for mankind. All the catastrophes that have attended this course of events at the Second War and seem to arise of purpose in order to prevent the working out of our intention have not prevented, and even further catastrophes will not prevent, the successful emergence and development of an enterprise which has become a necessity for the progress and perhaps the very existence of the race. So this is the first sign, the light on the horizon that Sri Aurobindo sees in his own lifetime. And so he wrote that book, Ideal of Human Unity, encouraging this movement of the United Nations. And then he would say, following this idea of UNO, he foresees the development of a world state without exclusions and on a principle of equality into which consideration of size and strength would not enter. So United Nations is the first step towards a world state. And a world state where each nation has an equal representation. It doesn't matter if USA is a huge, big country and you have Sri Lanka, which is a small country. Because each country, according to Sri Aurobindo, is a spiritual entity. We think a country is a geographical boundaries made up of people of a different culture, of a particular culture. But Sri Aurobindo in his analysis would tell us, each country is a living soul. Just as you and me and each human being has a soul within, he says each country has a soul. And there cannot be any kind of hierarchy among souls. Just as we are saying we are equal. I may be an Indian, you may be a German, somebody may be a Polish, somebody may be an American or a Chinese or Japanese. We feel all human beings are equal. Similarly, all nations are equal because each nation is what you would say represents a Shakti, represents a soul, represents a national soul, as he calls it, nation soul. And in fact, this is what the mother gave us at Oroville when she speaks of the international zone, that each nation must come there as the nation soul, not to represent saying if India is there or Germany is there, we take our clothes and our food and our little habits. So she says, find out what is the national soul of a country. I mean, it expresses itself in all this food and building and architecture, surely. So there again she emphasizes that Oroville must represent all the nation souls of the world in its international zone. That's a great effort. And of course, as some of these people who are here working towards for Oroville would understand the difficulty in bringing about this international zone. Well, as I told you, I have been in Oroville for 8 years in the beginning. The first inception of Oroville, I was there. The first years of my youth I spent there. So I see now after 41 years also, all the other sectors have come about. But it's the international zone which is not coming. is not the question of architecture. It is not the question of design. It is the question of reflecting a Unitarian consciousness in the world. Because Auroville has to reflect what is happening in the world. You see, Auroville can build a Matrimandir, can build an educational center or a living zone. But international zone represents the consciousness of the nations. So until and unless there is an aspiration in the nations to have a unity, international zone will not have its birth. However, that's a point maybe you'll hear later. So this is what Sri Aurobindo envisages, the international spirit. Now the second point, the second symbol or the signal of the future of humanity, he says, it is the emergence of the religion of humanity. Now this is the central concept. He says, humanity has to adapt this religion of humanity. Now what could be this religion of humanity? It is not a conglomeration of all the religions put together. Because there has been efforts where they said, let's put all the religions together, dialogue of all the religions, and we take the best out of everything. Well, how can there be the best of each religion? Each religion says, all this is best. Out of 100 points, 99 are best. So we cannot have a kind of a hodgepodge. So religion of humanity is not a kind of a synthesis of religions. For sure, Sri Aurobindo would say, it is the spiritual religion of humanity. So just the word religion of humanity may give us a mistaken understanding. So it clarifies saying it is the spiritual religion of humanity which will bring about this unity of mankind. Now what do we mean by the spiritual religion of humanity? Well, it is very simple. Spirituality believes in one divinity. And then all human beings, all that is created upon this earth, they're all part of this single divine reality. What we say in India, that Brahman is in all, all is in Brahman, and Brahman is everything. In India, we have always held this concept, this ideal, this vision, that this world is verily the Brahman. It is not the Brahman or the divine or the supreme reality has created and then left this world and watching it from above. This world is in the womb of the divine himself or herself. So that's why we call this manifestation a Shakti. Because any manifestation or force or energy is symbolized by Shakti in Indian philosophy. So that is how we have in Indian philosophy the concept of the Shakti, the energy, the deity, the Devi, which means it is that energy which manifests the divine. So we have this concept of Purusha and Prakriti. Most of you know that those two words. So Purusha, the divine, the Sachidananda, he conceives the concept. But what makes that concept reality is the Shakti, the energy, the divinity called the Mother Goddess. Or in Vedanta we called it Aditi. So that is why right from the beginning in India we have both the God and the Goddesses. The divine as male and the divine as female. Because there's a wonderful sentence from the mother when she was asked about her relation with Sri Aurobindo. She says, in one single sentence she gives the whole philosophy of the Vedanta. She says, without him, I exist not. Without me, he is unmanifest. So this is the role of Shakti. So that is why when we speak about the women power, the West has come about wonderfully is not the women liberation movement, but it is empowering the women and the Shakti. That's what brings about a manifestation of an ideal. Men are more or less abstract, abstruse in their thinking. But it is women who represents in Indian culture the prakriti, the nature, the one who realizes the ideal. That's why in the world today, there is such a great movement of the embodiment of women power. In India too, there is an awakening. Although we did respect the women power right from the beginning of our history as a deity, as a goddess, we revered women as a representative of Shakti. But you know, revering is one thing, but when it comes to social thought, it is another. So this is a spiritual ideal, but on the practical level, India has failed on its sociology. We have had great ideals, but when it comes to fulfilling, the nation did fail the women at a point. Well, now this is what Sri Aurobindo would say, the question of the spiritual religion of humanity, in which we believe in one single divine reality, in which we are one, that is, humanity is its highest representation in the world, that the human being is the means by which it will progressively reveal itself. So you see, this is one harmonizing, combining philosophy wherein we say, it is, we are all children of one divinity. Well, you say many religions have also said we are all children of one God. But it is not just this religious idea of children of one God. But it is a question that is this divine who is manifesting himself through humanity. And up until now, through evolution, humanity has come to the forefront. But now what Sri Aurobindo tells us is that till now there was a kind of an unconscious evolution from matter to life, life to the animal and the plant, and then to man. It took billions of years because it was unconscious movement. But now with the coming of man upon earth scene, he says the divine wants us to be collaborators in evolution. That we are conscious of our inner being. We can become conscious. Of course, if we choose not to be, well, it is our misfortune. But the sooner we realize that we have the divinity within, and it is for that that humanity has been created, that we have to be co-creators in this evolution. So this is the high ideal that Sri Aurobindo holds in front of humanity. And then he would tell us, lastly, that maybe this ideal seems to be too big, too imposing, that what Sri Aurobindo calls about the spiritualization. Many people may reject this idea, saying this is an impossibility, is a utopia. What Sri Aurobindo is speaking about can never happen. And many people nowadays talk about that. They say, look at the world today. Can you ever believe that it is the same humanity which will become spiritual? There are hardly any external signs. It's true, I agree. But did I not say Sri Aurobindo knew about all these catastrophes? He spoke about them. I mean, in every detail possible. It is not that he was blind to human suffering, the human catastrophes. But then he says, well, this radical change may seem too distant, may seem impossible. But then Sri Aurobindo asks us a question, am I asking you something that is not already there in the human being? If I am demanding a spiritual realization of your own being, that is the soul, the Atman. And then he says, I have shown you all the outer movement that have failed humanity. And if Sri Aurobindo were there in the physical body today, he would say, did I not tell you 100 years back that unless and until you turn to spirituality, there is no other path? But humanity took 100 years to experiment with all the other means and methods. But he says, at least now, consent to be spiritualized. One of the last postscript chapters, in the last postscript chapter of this book, in the last pages, he would tell us, if only mankind consents to be spiritualized. He says, if only, then humanity will be saved. All these sufferings, catastrophes could be saved. But obviously, we have not consented. So he says, if mankind consents to be spiritualized, it will not have to undergo through crushing circumstances. When that 9/11 happened, many of us spoke about that. That mankind is now being taken through crushing circumstances because we have not consented to be spiritualized. But mind you, nature will enforce us. First it will teach us through religion, through philosophy, through sociology, through religious thought. But if it did not change, did it not bring about the world wars 1 and 2? Just to bring about one concept of human unity? But prior to the world wars, no nation ever thought of a human unity. We all thought of German Empire, American Empire, Russian Empire, Asiatic Empire. We all thought of egoistically my empire. But for bringing about one single thought of human unity, nature enforced upon us this horror of the world wars. That is what we call the crushing circumstance. So Sri Aurobindo says, if only mankind can consent. So if there could be this inner consent, he says mankind would be on the right path. And then he would say that because what Sri Aurobindo is demanding is already a process of evolution. This is the second and the last argument. He says, I am not asking from humanity anything new. This discovery of the soul is a possibility because we all have an individual soul. And then the more important thing is, he says, I've seen this process of evolution. And friends, if you read this book, Idol of Human Unity, or The Human Cycle, you will see these two ideas. Of course, philosophically, it is explained marvelously in The Life Divine, his magnum opus of philosophy. But I won't venture out to suggest read that book. It is 1100 to 1200 pages. And even to look at that book, people will run away. In fact, in my class, people don't even bring that book. It's not only heavy in thought, but the heavy book. He says, sir, I can't bring that heavy book. So I would say, don't bring that. So what people have started doing is they're xeroxing each chapter and they bring that chapter to the class. So you see how lazy we are, even we can't even carry a book. So leave alone the question of understanding the philosophic thought. But Human Cycle is a small book, 200 pages, 250 pages. You can carry it, you can read it, you can understand that. Because that's the political situation we are in. It's not philosophy, it's reality of my own times. So Sri Aurobindo is telling us, have you not seen what I have written in this book? That it is nature's own evolutionary process. That nature herself wants to bring about this new age of spirituality. So Sri Aurobindo is only a kind of an announcer to nature's own aspirations. And that's why he calls his own integral yoga as yoga of nature. He doesn't say it is yoga, is my yoga or your yoga. So he takes this cosmic thing all the time. Yoga is yoga of nature. This social human thought is the process of nature. So in all this building of Oroville, building of this nation, building of UNO, these are all positive signposts, milestones, if I can call them, towards the right direction. And he would say that this is necessary, otherwise, I'll read out a sentence which normally Sri Aurobindo would not have written, but that's the only warning he gives in his entire book, telling here that it is besides a step for which the whole of evolution has been a preparation, and which is brought closer at each crisis of human destiny, when the mental and vital evolution of the being touches a point where intellect and vital force reach some acme of tension, and there is a need either for them to collapse, to sink back into a torpor of defeat, or a repose of unprogressive quiescence. What is necessary is that there should be a turn in humanity felt by some. This is the sentence I want to read. What is necessary is that there should be a turn in humanity felt by some or many towards this vision of change. So he's not asking entire humanity to change. He says, give me a few individuals, few groups, few attempts, who realize this necessity to change into a spiritual life. And then he would say, a feeling of its imperative need. This is exactly what the mother would say about Auroville also. That we see the need, that's why she called Auroville the city that the earth needs. So do we need this or not? You see, first let there be a burning need in my heart. How much I achieve it, it's a different thing. But do we feel something here? When there's terrorism, when there's violence, when thousands of people are killed everywhere, do we just go to our offices, sit our computers and drink our coffee and come out? Or do we feel the pain and the pang here? We feel the pain and the pang for humanity. But then you say, alas, what can I do? What can be done? If you ever ask this question, he says, that's the beginning of the salvation. So he says, at least feel this, the sense of its possibility, the will to make it possible in themselves and to find a way. He would say that the trend is not absent and it must increase with the tension of the crisis in human world destiny. What a marvel at each sentence is it was written 100 years back. And look at this, the trend is not absent, the trend towards this spiritual vision. He sees the signals right 100 years back. And it must increase with the tension of the crisis in human world destiny. So with every crisis, the latest one, meltdown of the economics, we go back, all the prime ministers, presidents of the G8, they meet together, they release $1 billion, $800 billion, and once again we forget that we have not found the solution. We have only released some more money, it will last you a decade or so, and then again we'll have to go through a crisis. So he says, how many times will humanity go through a crisis? Can we not awaken to the true solution? The need of an escape or a solution, the feeling that there is no other solution than the spiritual, cannot but grow and become more imperative under the urgency of critical circumstance. So this is the awakening to which he is really asking humanity to go forward and realize. And you see, as a yogi, philosopher, social thinker, he demands the least from humanity. He says, just consent to be spiritualized. Just feel the urge that spirituality could possibly be the only answer. He says, it's only out of these, some will take to yoga, some will practice, some will realize, some will attain. But there is a whole kind of a pyramidal structure. So there has got to be some human beings who realize, who feel. Then out of that a selected group will come forward to say, I will realize my own psychic being or the soul. Some will attempt, many will fail, but out of that a few will attain. Out of that, there will be more avant-garde, the pioneers. This is the movement that Sri Aurobindo is hoping for. And that is the solution, he says, that will bring in what Sri Aurobindo called the spiritual age. Well, it is not a hope of Sri Aurobindo's vision. Please remember, it is not a utopian thinking. He says, I have come only to announce what is already there on the horizon. You see, once I was flying back home, I think not flying back home. I was in Germany, somewhere down near Munich, and I had a ride, a balloon ride. I was mortally afraid of a balloon ride because I had fear of the heights. But my colleagues and friends said, "No, Anand, Dr. Reddy, you should experience this." So I was almost pushed into that basket. Well, I had a camera with me. And I think I remember the Divine most at that time. Because I didn't know how, what would be the experience of a balloon ride. But then before I could realize, suddenly I looked down and I was already 30 meters, 50 meters above the ground. And then it looked so, it was so lovely. I mean, you felt liberated. I mean, you are going up above the earth, seeing the beautiful farms, you know, in Germany, down south, the lovely green farms and little villages, little towns, little houses. As you went up and up, and it was early morning hours, 4:30. And at a certain height, suddenly I saw the sunrise. And the person who was in charge, he said, "You are seeing the sunrise now, but down below, those who are there in their houses, they cannot see the sunrise. They will see after half an hour. But we, because of our height, we are able to see the sunrise," and we all clicked our cameras and tried to catch that sunrise. But symbolically, this is exactly what Sri Aurobindo has done. From his yogic consciousness, from the heights of his consciousness that he attains in his sadhana, he foresees the rising sun of the spiritual age. So you and me, we may not believe. We may say, "No, it's still dark. I don't see any sunrise." And Sri Aurobindo writes in Savitri, "Belief shall be not until the work is done." He says, "God shall grow up while wise men talk and sleep," including in the Indian Embassy at Berlin. We may keep talking, but he says, "God shall grow up." So he is silently growing and he sees the growth. Because of his heights of his consciousness, he foresees. And for you and me, we may see the sunrise after 100 years or 200 years and then say, "Oh yes, somebody called Sri Aurobindo 300 years back had said that this would come." But even for that, let us know that somebody has announced the coming of the spiritual age. And if only we do not, I would not say believe him, I would say do not deny him. That would be the beginning of the consent of humanity to be spiritualized. Thank you so much. Do we have some time? Can I take some time? Or we should wind up? Well, a couple of questions perhaps, not to whatever I can clarify, not that I know much, but only I'm enthused by Sri Aurobindo's vision, not that I understand much. Yeah, maybe one or two. Yeah, I think she's bringing the mic.
Thank you very much for your speech. I don't know much about the spirituality and religion anyway. But a question came upon my mind, and I just was comparing the concept of spirituality. And you were talking about the spirituality and democracy and the concept of democracy, and that the root of wars and aggression is somehow the concept of not having a spirituality. In fact, the one who is not spiritual can be an enemy of mankind.
So, okay, now, can you explain that last one?
I mean, the one who is not spiritual.
Yeah.
Could be a kind of enemy of mankind.
Enemy of mankind.
Of mankind. And it reminded me just so of the concept of a religious person coming to me and saying, if you're not religious, if you don't believe on God, you go to hell. Why am I wrong? Do you think am I wrong?
Well, if you do not believe in God, you will never go to hell. There's a lovely story in India. You know, we had a great king called Akbar, and he had a very good minister called Birbal. So one day Birbal goes to Akbar and he says, Akbar had a question in the open session, the so-called the Sabha, as we call that, you know, his community of the ministers. He said, "I want you to tell me, who is greater, me or God?" Akbar asked the question. So, you know, it was a very difficult question, and you cannot deny Akbar that God is greater. But Birbal, one of his chief ministers, he said, "Sir, obviously you are greater." Then Akbar said, "Why?" He said, "You see, you can throw away a citizen of this country and you say you get lost from my country and go to another region." He said, "But God can't do that. How can he deny anybody saying, get away from this earth? Where will you go? From one part of the earth to another part is all him. So therefore, what you can do, God cannot do, so you are greater." That way, sir, no non-believer in God goes to hell. Because where is hell after all? As I said, the whole creation is in the womb of the Lord, of the Divine. So all this hell and heaven and all these are religious concepts which really want to control the human psychology and control human thinking. All hell and heaven is our own level of consciousness. So there's no question of atheist being, you know, condemned to hell or condemned to any other lower level. In India, in fact, atheist is also much honored. Non-believers, Aurobindo writes in one of his aphorisms. And if you come across his book called Aphorism, Thoughts and Aphorisms, do read that. Just simple sentences, you know, small 4 or 5 lines. He says, atheist is in fact the greatest theist. How come? Because he's constantly denying God. And by the denial of God, he's remembering God much more than the theist who believes in God but never thinks of God because he's lost in this world. So friend, there's no question of non-believers being enemies of God. There cannot be any enemy of God. It is again a religious thinking, and I think we should, spirituality takes us beyond this question of the sin, enemy, you know, this hell and heaven, etc. Yeah, you or somebody had a question, yeah?
Thank you very much for your wonderful speech. It was a sort of enrichment for us.
Thank you.
And my question is, you know, you have been talking about an internationalism, one world. If you talk about one world to advise the people. To advise the people,
yeah,
to live according to, say, Vedanta, and say, try to manifest the divinity in yourself, is very difficult and too general.
Yeah.
Could you imagine, like in Christianity, 10 commandments, a few norms, rules on basis of moral and ethic, which could be followed and formulated and followed by, say, world religion and world citizen?
You see, this internationalism is not based on any rules and regulations of any one particular religion or multiple religions. As I said, this concept of internationalism has the backup of the spiritual religion of humanity. So this spiritual religion of humanity goes beyond all these religions. It will not take up the 10 commandments, or it will not take up the scriptures of the Bhagavad Gita chapter 18 verse 64 to 65. It may start with all this, but Aurobindo announces very clearly in his writings that the age of religions is gone. It is spirituality that will really take up humanity and unite it. So as you say, it is not just a question of Advaitin saying Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, that this all this world is verily one family. You see, we will not impose any one Advaitic philosophy or Buddhist philosophy or Hindu philosophy or anyone. But through each religion, the person will turn to a greater consciousness wherein he does not differentiate, he does not reject the other religions. What is the main fallacy of religion today? Why is it being kind of outdated, if I can use the word? Because each one is saying, I am the best religion. The moment you kind of denounce this my best or I am being the best, then immediately you land in the periphery of spirituality. That means the very fact you say, no, my belief is mine, but yours is as great as mine. You have your path, I have my path. And this has been one of the fundamental Vedantic teachings itself, where Vedanta tells us three simple truths. He says, well, there is one divinity, but many expressions of the divine. Then he would say that the divine is not only transcendent, but is also immanent within each one of us. And then the third truth of Vedanta is that there are as many paths as there are people to reach the divine. So this is what we want to say about religion of humanity or spiritual religion of humanity. That each one, you may follow the Ten Commandments, you may follow the Buddhist commandments, you may follow the Hindu commandments. But this question of I alone or my religion alone can give you salvation, if that is withdrawn, I think we'll all go into the land of spirituality. And then that's the first point. Secondly, what Sri Aurobindo said, and I read out the quotation, that religion is not just pointing at the divinity, going to church or mosque or temple or gurdwara. Spirituality would say the temple is within us. The body itself is the temple of God. So any outer support is no more necessary in spirituality. It is all within. And the moment human beings realize that yes, there is the divinity within me. I can be traveling in the bus or the tram or the plane and I can still be in connection with the divine consciousness. That is spirituality. We don't have days and dates of the week to go to the divine. Here spirituality, God is liberated from those places called places of worship. Now you see, this is the Vedanta, that's a living Vedanta, that God is here beside me in all of you, that I'm speaking, that He is with me. So once this consciousness becomes more prominent in human nature, I think we are already beyond religion. So when we say beyond religion, let's not destroy religion. I'm not saying no, they'll be wiped off the face of the earth, no. But out of this religion, there will be a new dimension, if I can say, a dimension of a universality. So religion is individualistic, social context, and to a particular group, big group, small group. But spirituality is universal. So it is concept of universality extends itself to humanity. That we are one, not just because we have no European Union, we have Schengen visa, we can come to any European country. It's not one visa. It is the consciousness of oneness which will manifest itself in human unity. So Sri Aurobindo would say any concept of human unity must be psychologically based, not on the level of society or politics or Schengen visa or this or that. So it is, you know, that's what, again and again I come to Auroville, because that is one of those great experiments that is being done on the ground level. We are not speaking about human unity as a philosophy, but go back to Auroville and you will see it is being practiced. Not that it has attained, but at least everyone is conscious. Can we be united in spite of our differences? And the beauty is in spirituality, each one has to maintain his individuality. No one loses his nationality, no one loses his religion, no one loses his or gives up his own individual capability. So the beauty is spirituality is what we said about India, unity in diversity. Religion is just unity in a kind of a monotonous unity. Everyone should have the same dress, everyone should have the same symbol, everyone should have the same cap. This monotony of the sameness is religion, but spirituality is diversity. So the struggle becomes more intense, but that is what modernism wants. I want my freedom, and yet I want to reach a higher consciousness. So this is what Auroville is trying. 41 years have gone by. But as you know, as I said, Auroville is a reflection of the human consciousness in general. So Auroville will grow as human consciousness grows. And what will be the solution in Auroville will reflect back upon human society. Well, that would be a talk on Auroville. When I come back next time, we could talk about that. Yeah, I think there's one gentleman here.
I've read some books of Aurobindo, and I feel that he has a very deep insight into the general history and also in the philosophy. But my feeling is that this is for me for quite difficult to follow his path.
Difficult to follow the path?
His path, yes. It's so high that
I can't reach it. Yeah, I get that point.
Yeah, I think that was what I explained. She said, Sri Aurobindo himself says, what I'm demanding may be too high. But then, as I told you, jocularly, but I mean it, stretch your hand up. When you can't reach something on a rack, what do? You stretch your hand up, go up. That's precisely what we need to do. And that stretching your hand is what is called aspiration and surrender. You see, when you cannot reach, you call. You set your hand and say, Oh God, come down. This is the central philosophy of Sri Aurobindo's yoga. He says, you don't go to God. You call God to you, and He will come. But there are ways of calling. That's what he calls integral yoga. But that is why Sri Aurobindo is not difficult, is not unreachable. Because, you know, when you can't reach somebody, he says, I can't come to you, can you please come down? And the person, if he loves you, he comes down. So this is the central point in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. He says, you don't try to reach out to God. You just call him. Calling, aspiration, rejection, surrender. That is a formula of call. So he says, does anyone know Bengali here? Yeah. But there's another gentleman that I know. You know, in Bengali there's a line which says, Dak barbutun dakle ki kesto ashbena. If you know how to call the divine, will the divine not come to you? So there's a word called Dak barbutun dakle. The way you should call the divine, if you can do that, no God will resist. So this is precisely Sri Aurobindo's yoga, that we need to call him and say, Oh God, you're too far. I can't reach out. I can't even see you. But then, can you not please come down? And then Sri Aurobindo says, that is what is called bhakti. In fact, in India, we have this beautiful concept that God needs man as much as man needs God. That's the relationship of bhakti, of devotion. Because why does God need man? Because he wants to manifest himself. God is not up there saying, Oh, I'm beautiful, I'm fine, and I'm cozy heaven there. He says, I want to come upon earth into matter. And it is for you human beings who are to call me. And he says, I'm waiting. In fact, in Life Divine, anyone has read Life Divine here? Oh, great. Congrats. You have read that? Oh, lovely. I mean, appreciate that. So you can carry that thick book. You see, in chapter 5 of the Life Divine, he would say that the Divine in his creation has created the individual because it is the individual who can call the Divine, who has been given the onus of calling the Divine. So the whole purpose of you and me being created is that we can call him down into matter. That's why, friend, don't be discouraged saying what Sri Aurobindo says is too high. Well, actually, it is so close. Tagore has a poem. He says, my eyes cannot see the God because God is within my eyes. He's so close, you know, that you can't see him. That's the way you don't see the God, not because he's too far, because he is there within your eye. And that's the message the Sri Aurobindo says, he is within. It's only a question of opening and calling. And obviously, Sri Aurobindo would say, I challenge you, gentlemen, if it does not come, write to me.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's one person, forget. Okay? Oh, yes, Amen.
Thank you for a lovely talk. Can you suggest a good introductory book to Aurobindo? Because if you're saying it's a magnum opus, and such books are not introductory.
Yeah, obviously not. There is the very opposite of this magnum opus, the tiniest book, the two. One is called The Basis of Yoga, just 18 to 20 pages, and the book is crown size. So that's very small. But that is the yoga process, the basis of yoga. But then there's another book called The Mother. It's a tiny book like that, 4 inches by 6 inches, maybe 15 to 18 pages, in good font size 18. So there could be easier book. But, I don't know your good name.
Noel.
Pardon?
Noel.
Now you see, this is the tiniest book that Sri Aurobindo has written, but if I can tell you, that's more heavy than Life Divine. If you go into the book, it's a marvelous mantra. It is a mantra. But do read that. I mean, that gives you the essence of yoga. I mean, in just like dot points, you know. So you can understand that. And then after that, read The Basis of Yoga, which is a little more explanation of that. And then third level, I would say, read his letters on yoga. There are two volumes, but you know, letters are letters. 8 lines, 10 lines, 12 lines. Just flip through and you'll see all these points coming up. So at least you'll be able to understand. And who knows, at a point, you may write a letter back to Sri Aurobindo and saying, it's good writing. Yeah, there's a gentleman there. Is it over? Yeah, I think one last question because he has raised.
Does Aurobindo speaks also about angels? Angels who arrange the ideas of God and who already reach the supramental consciousness. Because if you speak of human mind, yeah, we learned in history that human minds failed over and over again, yeah? But what about angels who already reached supramental mind, yeah?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if you heard him. Are there these angels in Sri Aurobindo's yoga who have already reached the supermind and they could be the helpers to humanity? Yeah, that's the first time I'm getting a question like that. So, yeah, I can see its importance. But the concept of angels is quite different in Sri Aurobindo. It is not at all that the angels have reached the supermind. You see, in the cosmology that Sri Aurobindo gives us, it is like this. In fact, you should read a book called Savitri. Any fingers up? I know there are two or three here. Oh, great. Life Divine, Savitri, Life Divine. You are a good batch there. So Savitri is the magnificent poem, epic, 24,000 lines. I'm sure it will test your patience than anything else. So either read Life Divine, 1200 pages, or Savitri, 24,000 lines. But that's what is spirituality, patience and perseverance. In Savitri especially, he describes the different worlds that are there beyond the earth and the physical material world. He would tell us there are worlds which are called the subtle physical world, subtle physical, subtle vital, subtle mental. There is a Gandharva Loka, there are world after world, what he calls the world stair. So there is a kind of a staircase of worlds between this physical level and the supramental or the Satchidananda level. And it's important to know this staircase, because the purpose of staircase is twofold. One, you go up, and the other, you go down, you come down. And that is why Sri Aurobindo built this staircase of the worlds, because you can not only go to the divine Satchidananda, but bring him down the same staircase to this earth. Otherwise, God doesn't know how to come down. So thank you, Sri Aurobindo, that we have a staircase, and now I think Divine knows how to come down to earth. Now, it is this staircase, one of the rungs is the rung of the higher beings. We may call them the Gandharva Loka. In India, we call them the Gandharva Loka, which is the region of these angels. And these angels also belong to one particular level. Beyond them there are other levels of, say, intuition, of overmind, of supermind. So they are creatures or beings of a particular level of consciousness. They don't go higher, they don't come down. They are kind of the crystallized creatures. They are not evolutionary. They are there permanently on that place. So they can come down, or they do come down to the human level and to earth in order to help human beings. Help in human beings how? Not to take them to the supermind. Because they themselves don't know what is supermind. They cannot take it to supermind. But they can help us in arousing this kind of a spiritual aspiration. So the angels are there to give you a kind of a push towards the spirituality. But there are also on the other beings on that level, there are these dark forces, what we call anti-divine forces, which are also coming up on earth to sort of, you know, stop the human beings from going towards Godhead. So these are all forces that come upon earth to help or to impede man from going towards Godhead. So in Sri Aurobindo's philosophy, these are all levels of consciousness where each level has particular beings. And the human being is the lowest level. But out of all this, you know, there is a level of gods, what we call the overmental level. All these 33,000 gods that India has, plus maybe 55 from Berlin and 65 from Holland, all the godheads that you can put together, they are there on one particular level called overmind. And that is the level of the gods. Below that there are some other levels. Below that there is a Gandharva Loka of angels. Below that there are vital beings. Below that there are the, you know, sex beings. There are all this whole level is there. Well, if you read Savitri, that's book 2, you get this entire description. But if I can suggest, don't read book 2 right away. If you want to read Savitri, read book 1, jump to book 3, and go on till book 12, the 12 books in Savitri. come back to book 2. Because book 2 is nothing, is about 10,000 lines. Imagine almost half of Savitri. He described these words. So that itself shows you the importance of this ladder, the staircase. And he has given such graphic description of these beings. I mean, almost you can paint them. In fact, one artist in ashram has painted them. Such is the graphic description of the beings of each level. And then, but the thing is, at each level all these beings are static, non-evolutionary. And the only fellow upon this creation who is evolutionary is you and me. So we are the lowest in this creation, but we can become higher than the gods themselves. Because we can climb up the ladder and go to the overmind and into the supermind. So sure of Indos, another philosophy that mankind can achieve, because mankind alone has this soul, the psychic being. Even gods don't have a soul. They are powers who are crystallized powers. They are non-evolutionary, they are static. We human beings, we have this divine element called the soul within us, and that can evolve through the process of rebirth. And it is we alone who can evolve and who will evolve into that level of the supermind. And Sri Aurobindo, as I said, has foreseen that. Believe it or not, take it or leave it. Thank you so much.